All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it's March 16th, and we're going to move on to sensory chapter. I don't know if it's going to take two lectures to get through this material or not, but there's some strange twists in physiology in this particular chapter that you'll find very interesting. We'll apply your knowledge of membrane channels probably in some new and different ways. All right, so let's see. What does the schedule look like here? All right, sensory, endocrinology. Wow, we don't have an exam until after spring break. All right, so I'm not so concerned with the schedule at the moment. But you're still getting your tests back in lab. And, of course, if you want to see me regarding the test, just come by my office hours. You do not need an appointment, so anytime you come by is fine during my posted office hours. All right, so sensory chapter, what is a sense? What does it allow you to do? It allows you to communicate with your environment, be aware of the environment that's around you, on the outside of you, but there are also sensors that are inside your body that monitor things that are happening inside your body, and then your consciousness or your autonomic nervous system can use that information to maintain homeostasis, right? So that's the most important thing. So we're going to talk about some sensory receptors, some special senses. We'll have to define what a special sense is, and then look at some detail at these special senses, which include vision and hearing and a couple others. All right, so a receptor is some kind of structure that transduces one form of energy into another, right? And what are some modalities of energy that you want to be sensitive to? What would you want to have sensors for? Okay, I heard a lot of answers, but they all kind of blended together. Temperature, for instance, sure. Or maybe light, so that you can see, or maybe sound pressure, which is a mechanical wave moving through space so that you can hear things. All right, but what is the language that your brain works in? It doesn't work in terms of light or sound pressure or temperature. It operates in terms of action potentials, right? So your cerebral cortex is just operating with blips all the time. And the modality that it is perceiving depends on the part of the brain that action potentials are being developed in, and then the intensity. How is the intensity of a stimulus being appreciated as? Is it a different part of the brain? Same part of the brain, or what? It's going to be the same part of the brain, but the frequency of action potentials is what's going to determine the intensity of that particular appreciation, right? So the faster the intensity, the higher the amplitude of the particular sense is going to be. And I think in anatomy, you learn generally what parts of the central nervous system or what parts of the brain are responsible for different kinds of senses. Like for vision, where do action potentials go that allow you to appreciate vision? Occipital lobe, right? Okay, what about hearing? Ooh, I don't know if you guys can remember, but that would be temporal lobe. What about somatosensory signals? That is, touch and pressure on the surface of your body. Where do those signals go? Remember the precentral and postcentral gyrus? All right, and the precentral is the one that's responsible for initiating motor activity, but where you appreciate sensation from the surface of your body is the postcentral gyrus, right? And that's in what lobe of the brain is the postcentral gyrus. What is the central gyrus separating? Frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. So the postcentral gyrus is that first ridge of tissue that's in the parietal lobe. That's what gives you somatosensory appreciation. All right, so these sensors transduce environmental information into action potentials, and then those action potentials have to go to the right part of the brain for you to appreciate them. But action potentials are the common language of the nervous system. All right, so each type of sensor responds best to a particular modality, particular form of energy, for instance, like sound or light or pressure. You have different sensory receptors for that. And different modalities are perceived as being different because those action potentials that are generated by those receptors go to different parts of the brain, right? Like vision goes to the occipital lobe. So if we were to stimulate the occipital lobe just electrically, guess what would happen? Would a part of your body move? Would you smell something? Would you hear something? Or would nothing happen? What's the sense that's located in the occipital lobe? Vision. Yeah, you would see stuff. And it probably wouldn't be anything that you would recognize, right? It wouldn't be like words on a page. It just probably would be just nonsense to you. But nonetheless, you would have some kind of visual experience if we stimulated the occipital lobe. So remember, it's the part of the brain that's receiving action potentials determines what your perception is. Because all action potentials are what? How different are they? They're all the same, right? One action potential is the same as the next. And the only way that you have a different perception from different modalities is because different parts of the brain are receiving those action potentials. All right, so sensory receptors can be simple dendritic organs, right? Like here I see a dendrite wrapped around this hair follicle, so that if we wiggle this hair follicle back and forth, that's going to initiate action potentials that go to a part of your brain that you feel some kind of tactile sensation on the surface of your body, maybe a breeze blowing over your face or something, okay? Or sensory receptors can be specialized nerve endings, like this Pacinian corpuscle. It's way down here, deep in the dermis, or maybe in the hypodermis right here. So the kind of the type of event that a Pacinian corpuscle can sense is what? Very deep pressure, right? We also have some lighter pressure sensory organs, like a Meissner's corpuscle and Merkel's discs. And the Merkel's discs are even in the epithelium. They're very superficial. So these would be good for very light pressure or vibration. All right. So another way that we can classify sensory receptors is by the kind of modality that they respond to. So for instance, chemoreceptors can sense the presence or the concentration of a particular chemical. Right? And photoreceptors can sense the presence of light, right? And not only just sense the presence, but actually transduce that signal. What do we mean by transduce? Change it. Change it from light energy into what kind of energy? Like electrical energy in the form of action potentials that go to, right, the occipital lobe. So transduce is taking some form of energy, converting it into action potentials, and then sending it on its way to the proper part of the brain. Same thing for thermoreceptors. They respond to temperature changes. You have thermoreceptors in your periphery, but you also have central thermoreceptors that monitor your core body temperature, right? And mechanoreceptors, these are some of our favorite kinds of receptors, right? They respond, they generate electricity or action potentials when the cell membranes of these cells deform, and that can open up different sodium channels or potassium channels, so that can stimulate or inhibit a particular cell. And hearing is a really good example of a mechanical receptor, okay, because sound waves are physical, mechanical waves of pressure that move through the air. And when they hit your ear, these mechanical receptors in your inner ear then send action potentials to the temporal lobe, which then you perceive as sound. Nociceptors are receptors specifically responsible for pain. Okay, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, it's really a good thing, because if you're damaging part of your body, right, you want to be aware of that so that you can move your body away from that damaging stimulus, right? So nociceptors are good in that respect. And then proprioceptors, these are kind of strange. We don't talk about these a whole lot, maybe just a little bit. But they, you have proprioceptors in tendons, all tendons, and muscles and joints, and they send signals telling your brain what body position you're in, how much weight you're carrying, if joints are being angulated properly so that muscles aren't ripped apart, so that joints aren't destroyed. And they're also tied into, for instance, respiratory movements or respiratory urgencies, your urgencies to breathe. So when you start, and you're probably aware of this, when you start to move your body, guess what happens to you in terms of breathing? You stop breathing? Or does your breathing stay the same? Or do you start to hyperventilate when you start to exercise. Yeah, you start to hyperventilate. So these proprioceptors are also sending information to your respiratory center to adjust your respiratory rate so that you don't run out of oxygen. What would happen to you if you were to run out of oxygen? Maybe because you're not breathing properly. Yeah, you'd pass out. Okay. All right, so sensory receptors can also be not only categorized by what kind of stimulus excites them, but also where they're located in the body. So general receptors or cutaneous receptors are found in the surface of your body. Sometimes we call it the somatic region. Somatic receptors are near the surface of your body. And these respond to touch, pressure, temperature, or pain. And then we have special sense, sensory receptors. And the special senses are hearing, sight, and smell, taste, and two kinds of equilibrium. So we got to go over those things. And in order to see things, you need a highly advanced organ to do that. And for instance, that's, what do we call that? Very highly organized organ so that you can see things. Yeah, your eye. Okay, so special senses have a lot of complexity compared to sensory organs that are on the surface of your body. The other thing, the other distinction between a special sense and a general sense is that the general sensory organs are located all over your body. Right? The special senses are located in one or two areas, and that's it. So for instance, if we have an ice cube, what kind of sensory receptors are going to be stimulated by an ice cube? Is it going to be general or special? Okay, and some people said general, and I like that because if we take an ice cube and put it on the back of your neck, can you feel it? If we can put it on your belly button, can you feel it? Or the back of your knee or your big toe or whatever, you can feel that ice cube. So you have those sensory receptors all over the body. As opposed to if we take, instead of an ice cube, a sugar cube, and you want to have the perception of a sweet taste, if we put that sugar cube on your belly button, can you taste it? No. Okay, if we put it on your earlobe, can you taste it? No. Right? If we put it on your eyeball, can you taste it? No, it's only on your tongue, right? So only one specific location do you have that ability to perceive that stimulus. And the same thing for hearing, right? If we put a little earbud on your belly button, can you hear it? No, I mean, you might feel a little vibration or buzzing or something, but you won't be able to hear it, right? You need ears. And the same thing for all of the other special senses. Only one or two highly developed organs can transduce those particular signals. So we call that a special sense, as opposed to general. All right, so let me see if I can trick you. What about proprioception? Is that a general sense or a special sense? And remember, proprioception is what? Measuring tension in muscles, angulations of joints, general or special? That's a general sense because you have those receptors all over your body, in every muscle, in every tendon, in every joint, right? So that's a general sense. Even though it might seem kind of special to you, it's still a general sense. All right, so don't forget, what does a receptor do? It transduces some form of energy into what? Into action potentials. Right? And those action potentials go to that particular part of your brain for your perception of that modality. Right? And there are two different ways that we can think about receptors depending on what their behavior is. There can be tonic receptors and phasic receptors. And we got a pretty nice graph that shows that, right? That contrasts tonic receptors versus phasic receptors. And so a receptor is going to sense a stimulus. Right, so we're going to apply a stimulus at this point in time and then take it off a receptor at this point in time, but we're going to keep the amplitude of the stimulus constant. We're not going to change the amplitude. All right, tonic receptors respond by generating a constant rate of action potentials if the stimulus is constant. All right, so there is no change in the frequency of action potentials if the stimulus is constant. As opposed to a phasic receptor, once we turn on the stimulus and hold it constant for this period of time, Notice what happens to the frequency of action potentials. Does it stay the same, or does it increase, or does it decrease? It actually decreases. So when the frequency of action potentials decrease due to a phasic receptor right here, what is your perception? Is it increasing, staying the same, or decreasing? It's actually decreasing, right? So because the intensity of a stimulus is coded by the frequency of action potentials that gets to a certain part of your brain. All right, so this property of certain kinds of receptors like smell, certain kinds of touch, we call that adaptation. All right, so the nerves don't fatigue. It's actually the receptor that changes the potentials that it is developing to that constant stimulus. And that's probably a pretty good thing, because you could probably remember when you put your clothes on first thing in the morning, you can feel the clothes slipping on your body. Put your shoes on, you can feel your shoes being put on. All right, but what would happen to you if you felt that same stimulus all day long? Well, you would be distracted, right? Because it's not a very important kind of stimulus. So it is very good that adaptation takes place. And the same thing about smell. There are certain buildings that maybe have a characteristic smell to them. Does anybody remember a building that has a particular smell to it? I think of the library, okay, because all those books in there. And you walk into the library and you go, even with your eyes closed, you could say, oh, for sure, I'm in the library, I made it to the right building. But after 5 minutes, right, could you tell you're in the library anymore? No, not really. Okay, maybe if you really concentrated, okay, you could develop a sense of the smell of the library. Okay, it's not a particularly bad smell, I must say, in case there's anybody from the library going to listen to this lecture. And it's just characteristic of that building, right? Okay. So adaptation generally is a good thing. Now, what about pain? Should pain receptors adapt, would you guess? No, they should not adapt. They should always be telling your brain of damaging stimuli to your body so that you can remove your body from that damaging stimulus. All right, here is a concept that's called the law of specific nerve energies. And there's a couple questions, online questions, regarding this one right here. It says that stimulation of sensory fibers evokes only the sensation of that particular modality. All right, and there is a concept here of adequate stimulus. An adequate stimulus just means that it's a particular energy that can stimulate a sense organ. So, for instance, your eyes, what is the adequate stimulus for vision or for your eyes? Is it going to be pH? Is it going to be the smell of alcohol in the room or what? Yeah, it's going to be light. That's the adequate stimulus. All right, so the adequate stimulus requires the least amount of energy to activate a receptor. So different kinds of energy might stimulate a receptor, but it has to be a much higher energy. So, for instance, has anybody ever seen things that really weren't there in reality? Okay, like, did you ever hit your head, is what I'm talking about, not other kinds of things that you might be thinking about. How about if something poked you in the eye, okay, and all of a sudden you had this big pressure wave be transmitted through the vitreous humor and aqueous humor of your eye and hits the retina, and that's going to cause depolarizations in the retina, just that pressure wave, and you might see sparkles or something, right? But, yeah? Really, really cold, so maybe even temperature might even stimulate the retina. Wow, I don't think I've done that. Brain freeze. Oh, you're talking about, okay, painful sensation. Okay. Well, I want to go back to that pressure wave. So you might be able to see things, right, in your visual cortex, your occipital lobe, that weren't necessarily generated by light, but it has to be a pretty powerful stimulus in order to do that. All right, so that's really not an adequate stimulus. That's an inappropriate kind of stimulus. Oh, I want to just slide down over here. All right, so different kinds of receptors can be categorized based on what their adequate stimulus is. Like mechanoreceptors are going to be most sensitive to mechanical force, because some kind of mechanical force is going to deform the cell membrane. Right, and then these cells are going to generate action potentials that get sent to the brain. Pain receptors measure tissue damage. When tissues are damaged, they release different kinds of chemicals, right, that excite sensory nerve endings. And we're going to talk about some of those, like substance P. Chemoreceptors respond to dissolved chemicals. So chemicals interact and maybe change the permeability of ion channels in the cell membrane, right, which can depolarize or hyperpolarize the cell, which then can either be excitatory or inhibitory on a neuron. And then we're going to spend a lot of time looking at some photoreceptors. Photoreceptor cells respond to light because light can change chemical properties inside the cell, which are going to change various ion currents in the plasma membrane. Okay, so these are a class of receptors, and then here are the adequate stimuli for each of these particular receptors. All right, so what kinds of electrical potentials have we talked about already? I can think of three. So action potential is one. Oh yeah, IPSPs and EPSPs, let's talk about those as being graded potentials. So action potentials, what, are constant. They get transmitted without decrement. A graded potential doesn't have a threshold, and as it flows over a cell, it decreases in amplitude. It kind of dies away. So you got action potential, graded potential, and resting membrane potential. Okay, so I can think of those three. Well, here's another kind. These are what we call generator potentials. Generator potentials get generated by sensory nerve endings. Okay, and you can see that they're most like graded potentials. So let me see. So here we have a number of different kinds of generator potentials. I'm trying to figure out the color of that thing. I don't know if it's yellow or orange or green or whatever. Okay. But you can see that there are different amplitudes of a generator potential that's being produced by a sensory receptor. And if these graded potentials reach the axon, the initial segment of an axon, okay, at threshold, then that's going to develop a action potential that's going to be sent to a particular part of the brain. Right, and the amplitude of this generator potential right here is proportional to the stimulus strength. So as the stimulus strength of an adequate stimulus increases, right, then this generator potential amplitude increases. and eventually it will reach threshold and create an action potential. All right, so one and two right here are sub-threshold stimuli, but number three is a threshold stimulus. And notice that if this generator potential was going to die away right here, right? But if another generator potential, maybe like at the level of number two, came along right at this point in time, remember these generator potentials can summate. So if we put the remnants of number three with a number two at this point in time, that's probably enough to overcome this relative refractory period. And right at this point in time, that's going to generate another action potential. Right? So the amplitudes of these generator potentials, right, can change the frequency of action potentials that are going to be sent to the brain. So these generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. Right? And after a threshold is reached, the action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. And in phasic receptors, the generator potential does what with a phasic? It adapts, right? So the frequency of action potentials actually decreases as a result for a phasic, right? So then you appreciate a decrease in intensity. All right, so for a tonic receptor, for a particular stimulus that's held constant, the rate of action potentials is going to be held the same. So here we have a graph of action potentials that are produced by these generator potentials. And what produces these generator potentials? What can produce a generator potential? The stimulus down here, right? So I want you to understand cause and effect. So a stimulus will produce generator potentials. Right? And what's the relationship of the amplitude of this generator potential compared to the amplitude of the stimulus? As the stimulus increases, what happens to a generator potential? It increases as well, right? Okay. And Remember, generator potential doesn't have a threshold, but what does have a threshold? Action potential does. So if a generator potential reaches threshold like we see right here, that's going to trigger some action potentials. Now the frequency, because this is just barely a threshold stimulus, the frequency of action potentials is pretty slow. These action potentials are far apart. Because this threshold voltage right here is not enough to overcome what area of an action potential? What do we call this area down over here? That's the relative refractory period, right? And the relative refractory period eventually dies away. And when it dies away, this generator potential reaches threshold once again, and at a late time, that triggers another action potential. But what happens now if we have a super threshold stimulus, a very strong stimulus? Look at it, the rate of action potentials that is being generated. It's a high rate, a high frequency. How do you explain this high rate of frequencies of action potentials with this third stimulus right here? Because if we go back, right, that generator potential can overcome this relative refractory period so that an action potential can be triggered right away as soon as this neuron recovers. Right? It can overcome this area of relative refractory period. All right, special senses. I guess let's list the special senses. And I'm just going to talk and you write them down. So special senses are in one or two places in your body, or you have receptors in one or two places in your body. And we said vision. Sight is a special sense, only on your eyeballs. Let's see what else. Taste, only on your tongue. Smell, only in your nose, right? Can't smell with your fingertips. Hearing with your ears. And then two kinds of equilibrium or balance, which are also in your ear. And those are called static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. I really want to walk to the board and actually write that down. Let's see if the microphone is going to behave. All right, so what was the first one I mentioned? Vision. Okay, vision. That's your eyes. Taste. That's gustatory. Sense. Gustation is taste. Smell. Oh, what's smell really called? Olfaction. Right, I might just put gustation here to make it all the same. All right, and then we've got hearing and two equilibrium senses. Okay, so static equilibrium, and I'm just going to abbreviate EQ, and kinetic. EQ, and maybe a good way to think of these different kinds of equilibrium is to say that static equilibrium can sense linear acceleration. Linear means what? Straight line. Forwards, backwards, right, left. Acceleration just means changing velocity. All right, so if you're moving at 10 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, that's not acceleration. You have to change your velocity. All right, kinetic equilibrium is not linear acceleration. It's a rotational acceleration. And the word that people like to use for rotational is angular. Angular. What's another way of saying angular acceleration? Angular. Y'all did it. I know. Spinning, okay? When you spin, that's angular, right? So you're not changing position, you're just standing in one position, spinning around. All right, so these are all special senses. And vision is in your eyes, gustation is tongue, olfaction is nose, hearing is, your ear, and three parts of the ear. Static equilibrium, one part of the ear, namely the inner ear, and kinetic equilibrium, even another part of the inner ear. All right, so those are special senses. All right, so taste and smell are extroreceptors because these receptors respond to chemicals that are in the external environment, not inside you. All right, so external environment, as opposed to other kinds of receptors, like pH receptors and the arch of the aorta and the carotid arteries. Those would be interoceptors, right, because they're responding to chemicals inside you. All right, so the taste of gustation can detect some basic senses, and there's five basic senses. We have sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and some amino acids, which give you the sense of fulfillment or pleasure when you eat something, and sometimes we call that umami. All right, so you got sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. And these receptors are located in taste buds. So here we see a taste bud right here. We see a number of different cells. So we see the gustatory taste cell, and there are projections almost like cilia. These cilia are not motile, but there are, sometimes we call these hairs that project away from the gustatory cell right here. All right, so I can, and this taste bud might be made up of 100 different kinds of cells. So is this something that you can see with your naked eye? So if you look in a mirror and go, ah, can you see something like this? Yeah, what would you need to see a taste bud? Yeah, you need a microscope, right? All right, so you might say, well, what are all those things on your tongue that you see? People do call those things taste buds, but they're not really taste buds, but you should know because you've had anatomy already. What are those things called? Those things that kind of the people call taste buds on your tongue, what are those things called? Those are called papillae, okay? And so they're not really taste buds. So you have hundreds or thousands of taste buds on every papillae that are on your tongue, and you could go back to your anatomy book. There's different kinds of papillae. There's big ones and small ones arranged by area on your tongue. Okay, so these taste buds are located internal to the taste papillae, and there is a pore right here, and the tastant molecules have to enter this pore and actually bind to the taste hair right here, or somehow enter the cell in order for you to perceive taste. So here's a mechanism that you have those five different senses. Now this figure right here is not in your book. So I provide it for you in the study guide and also in the PowerPoint presentation right there. All right, so the first sense is salty. And what kind of chemical is salt? It is? It's not part of this class, but probably everybody knows before they take this class. It's what? Sodium chloride. All right, and have you ever heard of sodium before? Yes, okay, because that's how membrane potentials are developed and how action potentials travel, for instance. All right, so when you have salt in your diet, that sodium, and remember, sodium chloride dissociates right away when you put it in water, so you get this nice sodium ion. And there is a channel for sodium in this particular hair cell, so that when there's a high concentration of sodium in your saliva, guess what happens? It enters the cell through that sodium channel. And when sodium enters the cell, what's the electrical event called? Depolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory, right? So that causes depolarization. That depolarization comes down to the base of this cell right here. There are calcium voltage-gated channels that open up that allow calcium to enter this cell. And that's going to cause these neurotransmitter vesicles to move, to dock and fuse to this is like a presynaptic membrane, releasing excitatory neurotransmitter onto this sensory neuron, which then is going to generate graded potentials, which will eventually cause action potentials, which will reach your brain, and it's going to go to the gustatory cortex, which then gives you the sensation of salt. Okay? So that's a pretty simple mechanism. All you have to realize is that there are sodium channels that are open all the time, so sodium can enter the cell. All right, sour is another unique modality, and it's due to hydrogen ion concentration, or the concentration of acid. All right, and hydrogen ion is just a cation. There are specific hydrogen ion channels so that when you have high acid in your mouth, that proton enters through this channel, which causes depolarization, okay, which then, when that depolarization reaches these voltage-gated channels right here, calcium can enter this cell. Because where is calcium usually at a high concentration? Outside the cell, so when a calcium channel opens up, calcium enters the cell, that causes the release of excitatory neurotransmitter, which then sends action potentials to the brain via this sensory nerve right here. So salty and sour tastes work pretty much by the same mechanism, just through these ion channels right here. Yeah.
The channels are only on those taste hairs?
Only on those taste hairs of these particular cells, right? So a particular hair cell won't have a whole bunch of different kinds of receptors, right? So a taste cell will have one particular kind of ion channel or a receptor. Okay. So you could send the sign-in sheet around anytime already if you already did. Fantastic. Okay. All right, so that's two senses. How many more do we have? Yeah, we got three more. Okay. So we have sweet and umami work this way. All right. So there are molecules that by their shape bind to receptors, which are G-protein-coupled receptors. So the G-proteins become activated, which create a second messenger inside the cell. Can anybody give me maybe an example of a second messenger? Like cyclic AMP? Cyclic AMP now will diffuse around through the cell, and it's going to bump into a potassium channel, which is normally open. So if this potassium channel is normally open, what's the state of this cell in the absence of a stimulus? In the absence of a stimulus, what's the state of the cell if potassium is leaking out all the time? Okay. What happens when potassium leaks out of the cell? Does it become more negative on the inside or more positive on the inside? More negative, what do we call that? Hyperpolarization, right? And if a cell is hyperpolarized, is it close to threshold or far away from threshold? It's far away from threshold. So in the absence of a stimulus, this cell is really far away from threshold because potassium is leaving the cell all the time. But, for instance, if the second messenger builds up and it closes these potassium channels, now what happens? It actually becomes depolarized because potassium can't leave the cell. It depolarizes, and when it depolarizes, right, that causes the release of excitatory neurotransmitter onto the sensory neuron right here. So sweet and umami work the same way. And, okay, our last kind, the bitter sense. So you could give me an example of a sugar. What's an example of a sugar? Yeah, like glucose. Okay, and for sour, that's hydrogen ion. What else did we have? Sodium, that's just a sodium ion. All right, the taste, the sense of bitterness, right? A good molecule to think of is quinine, and you can go get some tonic water which has quinine in it, and you can probably remember what that tastes like. It's a bitter sense. So that molecule binds to a receptor, and again, it's a G-protein coupled receptor, which acts through a second messenger. This particular second messenger, okay, causes the release of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum. So endoplasmic reticulum function, you might remember, partly it's due, partly does what? Lipid synthesis, but it can also be an area for storing calcium ions. So this second messenger causes release of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum. That calcium signal then causes the release of excitatory neurotransmitter onto this neuron right here. All right, so in a couple cases, we see that they're just direct ion channels, and in a couple other cases, is it going to be like a ligand-gated ion channel or a G-protein-coupled receptor? Yeah, G-protein-coupled receptor, which changes permeability or the state of the resting membrane potential in these cells. All right, so again, that just kind of underscores the importance of G-protein-coupled receptor mechanisms. All right, so this is a nice exam figure. One thing I think I forgot to say is that in terms of sweet and umami, this second messenger, right, acts through calcium channels right here. It will bind to these calcium channels and open up calcium channels, which then acts as a signal to depolarize the cell, and that calcium signal also causes the fusion or docking of these synaptic vesicles and the release of neurotransmitter. All right, so sweet and umami, calcium enters the cell or enters the cytosol via these ion channels in the plasma membrane, as opposed to bitter, right? Calcium concentration increases in the cytosol due to release from the endoplasmic reticulum. Oh, and in particular, what kind of endoplasmic reticulum is that? Did I say? I hope I did. Yeah, smooth. That's a smooth endoplasmic reticulum, not the rough endo. What's the function of a rough endoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, protein synthesis for secretion, basically, right, for exocytosis. All right, so that's the sense of gustation. All right, olfaction, I don't think we'll spend too much time with, but there's a similar kind of mechanism. Okay, there are, let's see if we can see what's going on right here. Oh, gee whiz. What bone is this? Ooh, what bone is that? Let's have some fun real quick with this. That's like the, okay, that's the hard palate made up of the maxilla, right? Okay, and then we've got frontal bone, maybe nasal bone right up over here, and then sphenoid, because there's a nice sphenoid sign. Oh, look, I see a little cella turcica right there. What's hanging out in the cella turcica? Anybody remember? Okay, we're going to get to that eventually. That's where the pituitary gland is, right? So here's a sphenoid sinus. And then between the frontal bone and sphenoid, we've got the, okay, for those of you that know, that's my favorite bone, that's a ethmoid bone, right? So there you got the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone with all of these olfactory foramina, so that these olfactory nerves can actually get down in your nasal cavity right here. And this is a really strange part of your body, because it's the only place where you actually have part of your nervous system dangling out in free space, right? So you actually have nerves hanging down in your nasal cavity. And of course, they're protected a little bit by some epithelial cells and stem cells. And here we see an olfactory neuron. And there are some of these cilia, which again have receptors on them, so that odorant molecules, when they enter your nose, they have to bind to these G protein coupled receptors, which then change the electrical properties of these cells. And you're probably aware, for instance, if you really want to smell, maybe you're interested in a particular chemical in lab or something, what do you have to do to perceive that chemical? You've got to waft it up into your nose, but what else do you have to do? You have to sniff, right? You got to get those particles way up into the superior part of the nasal cavity, because that's where you have those receptors at. Okay, so, thanks so much. There's a sign-in sheet. Looking good. All right, so here is the olfactory bulb. Here are the neurons for the sense of smell or olfaction. And this is going to, when an odorant molecule binds to these receptors right here, that's going to cause action potentials, which then go to the olfactory part of the brain of the cortex. Now these receptor cells, these receptor neurons, have a pretty hard life if they're just dangling in space, because they're being surrounded with what's ever in the atmosphere. They don't live for very long, right? And so they're regenerated by stem cells that are in the epithelium right here. And I think that's pretty interesting that you have nervous system stem cells that are operating in you all the time, replacing these sensory neurons. From what standpoint is that really interesting? What about your nervous system in terms of regeneration? What's your impression of regeneration, the regenerative properties? Like the spinal cord, once it's damaged, what happens to it? It doesn't heal, right? But here we have a whole bunch of stem cells. Are these easy to get at? Well, yeah, real easy. They're just right in your nose, right? So wouldn't that be a marvelous thing if we could get some stem cells from somebody, turn them into neurons in the spinal cord, transplant them into the spinal cord, and then all of a sudden somebody can regenerate their spinal cord? That would be amazing. Okay, I'm sure somebody's working on that.
Do they stop regenerating
themselves? At some point in time, I'm sure as you get older, they run out of steam. Okay, I'm sure that is true. Okay, so elderly people don't have the same sense of smell as compared to younger people. Yeah. And I don't know where that is. Depends on, you know, the behavior of that individual. So if you're a factory worker, I'm sure you lose your sense of smell early on, right? Because you're just traumatizing this epithelium right here. Or if you're a smoker of various kinds of substances, I'm sure that has a deleterious effect on your sense of smell as well, okay? So the gentler you are to this tissue, you know, the better off you're going to be in terms of olfaction.
What about people that have, like, for all intents and purposes, a more refined palate?
Oh, sure.
Oh,
the sense of perception, what is that due to? Well, it's due to, it could be due to structure, okay? Maybe different kinds of receptors or different number of receptors, like for taste. You still have those five different senses, but maybe there's a different number of each of those categories. But a lot of these senses are due to your exposure. So I'm sure culture plays a large role in what you can perceive. And certainly what you perceive as pleasant or unpleasant, all right? So just your cultural background. And so I think those are probably the most important things. Okay, so, and then some people just might have more receptors. So even with there's a country where people generally accepted don't have a sense of taste, okay, a gustatory taste, and that would be England. Okay, and people make fun of them all the time because if they have pizza, how would they cook it? They would boil it, okay? Or if they have a steak, they boil it. Or if they have cabbage, they boil it, and that kind of kills the taste of everything, okay? I forgot the point I was trying to make. Oh, but culture, just that culture, all right, really has a lot to do with your development of taste. Now, there was another point I was trying to make, but I forgot because it was fun to talk about them. Okay, so let's see. Let's get back to the sense of smell before I got off track here a little bit. So you've got the receptor cells that are bipolar neurons. You're going to see maybe in anatomy you realize that you don't have many places where you have bipolar neurons. Mostly they're, unipolar neurons or multipolar neurons. But in the special senses, we see bipolar neurons. They send axons to the olfactory bulb. We've got basal cells in the epithelium, right, that produce new receptor cells every couple of months. And then you do have other support cells in this epithelium that work hard to detoxify compounds that enter your nose that are going to kill these sensory neurons right here. Right, and in every case, odorant molecules have to bind to a G-protein coupled receptor, which is going to send action potentials to the brain. And in this particular case, for the sense of taste, there are five primary taste sensations. But for smell, I don't think we have a clue how many different kinds of receptors there are. There are thousands of different kinds of receptors. And that might explain why some people have different kinds of taste sense smell sensations than others, because right, the number of different kinds of receptors an individual can have is highly variable, and there are thousands of different kinds of receptors, unlike for taste, right, which basically have five. But nonetheless, you can appreciate a whole range of different tastes based on primary sensations. For instance, let's maybe go back to the sense of gustation for a second. And can you think of a food that in your mind you can actually break down into its various components? Can you think of a food that's that is part bitter, part sweet, part sour? What's a really good example of something that probably you all have had that is bitter and sweet and sour and probably grapefruit? Well, what I'm particularly thinking of is a margarita. Okay, can you taste salt in a margarita? Yeah, or bitter, or sour. Absolutely, all those senses, right, go to a particular part of your brain from those receptors, and then you synthesize that particular compound in your consciousness due to the stimulation of those receptors. Okay, so the same thing for smell, but what, only orders of magnitude more complicated. All right, so let's go to another special sense, and that is hearing, and or your ear. And we're going to talk about all the senses of your ear. And the senses are hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. So this is the apparatus that's in your inner ear. What bone is this in? Anybody remember what bone this is in right here? That's the temporal bone. What part of the temporal bone? You could say squamous part, but you would not be correct. That is the petrous region, right? The petrous region between the external auditory meatus and the internal auditory meatus. And you know what? I'm going to flip through these slides really, really fast to get to this picture because I have it in the wrong spot. Ah, right here. All right, so this kind of reminds you of anatomy a little bit. It's an okay picture. But at least it shows you that where the external ear is, where the internal ear, middle ear is, and the internal ear. All right, so here's the external auditory meatus, including the pinna of the ear. So this is your external ear, and it stops right at the tympanic membrane. And sound is a mechanical wave, which is going to vibrate this tympanic membrane back and forth. So the sound vibrations move through the middle ear right here because they're transmitted via these auditory ossicles, which are tiny little bones, which I have all three right here between my fingers. And could you tell me I was pulling your leg or not? You couldn't tell me because those bones are so small, they all would fit very nice and neatly between my fingertips. All right, so you should probably remember the names, right, the stapes, incus, and malleus right here, of these three bones. And this compartment also has air in it, should not have fluid. Right? And this right here is the inner ear. And the inner ear is filled with fluid. And it is very difficult for sound energy to that goes from air, for that energy to enter a liquid. It's very difficult to do that. So for instance, if maybe you've been swimming at some point in time, maybe you've even taken a shower, maybe. That's even a better way. Right? But say if you're swimming and you have your head above water and you're talking to somebody that's out of the pool, you can have a normal conversation. But now, what happens to your ability to understand that person or hear that person if you put your head underwater? Can you hear them? No, it gets muffled out. That's because of the properties of air and water are quite different. So in order for to get sound that's in this external acoustic meatus into this apparatus right here, which is the cochlea, the sense for hearing, it has to be amplified and the properties have to be changed. And so that's the process of the tympanic membrane. Look at the huge surface area of the tympanic membrane compared to the surface area of the, what is this thing right here? That's a window. What kind of window does it look like? Does it look square, triangular, circular? It looks oval because that's the footprint of the stapes, right? So that's the oval window. It's a small surface area. So if you have a large surface area of this tympanic membrane pressing up against a small surface area, that's like a level of amplification, right? So it's easy for sound to enter your ear because of the difference in surface area right here. But also, these ossicles act as another system of amplification to amplify sound signals so that they can enter the fluid environment of the inner ear. All right, let's see if I want to say anything else about this. Just remember, yeah, you should know all this stuff, like the eustachian tube right here, that's for equalizing pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. So if you go up in the mountains and the pressure in this external auditory meatus decreases, the pressure in the middle ear can also decrease so that the tympanic membrane can vibrate right around zero pressure. But if you have a cold and the tympanic membrane is plugged, now you have high pressure in the middle ear, which is going to push the tympanic membrane all the way to one side, so now it can't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, can you hear anything? No. All right, so right, you're told different ways to maybe unplug this tympanic membrane by yawning or pressurizing your nose like a Valsalva maneuver, or taking decongestants, for instance, if you have a cold, okay, to help equalize pressure within the middle ear compared to this external ear. All right, so what we're going to focus first, I think, are the senses of equilibrium, which have to do with what part of the ear, outer ear, middle ear, or inner ear. It is this inner ear right here, and we're going to call that the vestibular apparatus, which is this part right here, which is responsible for equilibrium, as opposed to the cochlea right here, which is responsible for hearing, right, and not equilibrium. All right, so let me flip back. to somewhere around over here. All right, so here we have a nice zoomed in region of what part of the ear? External, middle, or inner? Inner. You got the inner ear, right? And so here's the cochlea, here's the vestibular apparatus. Cochlea for hearing, once again, vestibular apparatus for equilibrium. And, oh, look, here we have a nice nerve right here. It used to be called the auditory nerve, right? It's a cranial nerve. But now what's it called? More aptly named. Remember on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop, and people always ask, well, how did that A get in there? Because of the auditory nerve, but now it's what? The vestibulocochlear nerve. Ah, look, it's still kind of misnamed right here. Vestibular cochlear nerve. Okay. All right, so the vestibular apparatus provides a sense of equilibrium, and that is an orientation to gravity. And that's in the inner ear. And let's talk about, I think, this part right here, which is the vestibule. The vestibule have a couple organs, the utricle and saccule, which give you the sense of linear acceleration. All right, and so here we see the vestibule. And it's filled with fluid on the inside. So the bony labyrinth is what we call the vestibule. The utricle and saccule are special organs inside the vestibule. All right, so the way that it works is that there are hair cells inside the utricle and saccule. All right, and it's not hair, for instance, like what you have on the top of your head, but there are little cilia that project from the apical surface of these hair cells, and they're connected to each other. These are mechanoreceptors. And when these stereocilia deform the cell membrane, it opens or closes sodium channels, which is what? A way of saying that it can either excite or inhibit these particular cells, right, which then going to change the rate of action potentials that are going to go to your brain to help understand body position or equilibrium. So these things are called stereocilia. They're connected to the kinocilium, which is connected to the ion channels that are in the cell membrane right about here. All right, so because underneath a microscope, these kind of look like hairs, we call them hair cells. All right, so in the vestibule, in the utricle and saccule, both the utricle and saccule are what we call maculae. Okay, there are otolith organs. So here we see these hair cells. Can you see the stereocilia poking up into a gelatinous mass? So here's a little gelatin that these stereocilia are projecting up into. All right, so this would be a really good example. Okay, this would be a really good example of the utricle. And this gelatin can deform depending on how gravity pulls on it. And gravity, the effect of gravity is going to be accentuated because within the gelatinous mass, there are actually little rocks, right? So there are heavy rocks that we call otoliths. And these rocks are made out of calcium carbonate. So there's calcium carbonate crystals. Gravity pulls on them. Right, and in this particular case, gravity is pulling straight down and it's not bending the stereocilia one way or the other. Right, but if you were to tilt your head, what would happen to this gelatinous mass? It's heavy because of these otoliths, or these little crystals right here. If you bend your head forward, gravity is going to pull down and it's going to deform these stereocilia, which is going to increase the number of action potentials that are being sent to the brain. So even though, okay, so this organ right here, right, the utricle and saccule can measure head position because gravity is going to pull down one way or the other on these hair cells. And this is similar to acceleration. Gravity is very, very similar to acceleration. Let's just model this person with their head upright once again and say they're in your car, and you hit the accelerator, what's going to happen to these otoliths? They have momentum. They want to stay in the same place. When you accelerate, they're going to pull the stereocilia posteriorly, which is going to change ion currents in these nerve fibers right here, and so you get the sense of what? Linear acceleration. And the same thing if you're traveling 60 miles an hour and you hit the brakes, what's happening? That's an acceleration, but we call that deceleration. So those otoliths still are traveling at 60 miles an hour. When you hit the brakes, they're going to move anteriorly, right, deforming the stereocilia, and once again you have the sense of a change of acceleration. But at a constant speed, right, they don't send any information to the brain, because if you're traveling at 60 miles an hour and the otoliths are traveling at 60 miles an hour, it's not what? It's not bending the stereocilia one way or the other. So gravity and acceleration work the same kind of way, linear acceleration. Okay, so what's the receptor cell that is sending action potentials to the brain? Yeah, it's the hair cells that are doing that. Okay, there are similar kinds of setups in these semicircular canals here and here. Now, these aren't responsible for linear acceleration. They're due to angular acceleration or spinning or twisting. And the reason why that is because these semicircular canals, right, fluid can flow in a circle within them, right? And notice that these three semicircular canals are oriented in three different planes. And how many planes do you need to describe your person in anatomy? What were the planes? Transverse? Coronal or frontal plane? And what's another one? Sagittal, right? So those are the three basic components of space, right? So if we want to describe where I have this marker right here, how could you completely describe where this marker is in the room? You have to tell me three things. How far away it is from maybe the front wall, all right, anterior, posterior. How far away it is from the right wall, so right, left. What else would you have to tell me? Okay, how high off the ground it is, right? So we've got a transverse plane, sagittal plane, and a coronal plane to tell you exactly where this particular marker is. So we need these three planes to understand how we are spinning in space. All right, so they tell you a sense of rotational acceleration because these tubes have fluid and they interact with a special organ in this bulge at the base of each of these semicircular canals, and we call this an ampulla. An ampulla is what? Just a tiny, tiny vial that's holding something. And it's holding an organ that can measure the flow of fluid across it, and we call that the crista ampullaris. So the crista ampullaris is kind of analogous to the utricle and saccule, but it has a little bit different kind of arrangement. All right, so here is the crista ampullaris organ inside the ampule of a semicircular canal. And what kind of receptor cells do you see? Once again, hair cells with the stereocilia poking up into a little gelatinous mass. It's a little bit tougher gelatin compared to the gelatinous mass and the utricle and saccule, and we call it the cupula. All right, so when the cupula deforms, when fluid tries to flow past the cupula, it's going to bend these hair cells one way or the other. All right, and fluid can only flow through these semicircular canals in what kind of direction? A straight forward and back direction or a spinning direction? Only when the person is spinning can fluid flow through these canals, because it's a circular canal. All right, so how does that happen? How can fluid change? All right, so I've got an example right here. The fluid inside the inner ear is called endolymph, okay? And let's pretend I have endolymph in this bottle, right? So the fluid in this bottle is endolymph. It has mass, so it has inertia. And I don't know if anybody has studied physics to know what inertia is, okay? But inertia just says that anything that has mass likes to stay stationary if it is still, right? But the other thing that inertia says is once mass has velocity, it likes to continue traveling at that velocity. It doesn't want to change, All right, so inertia means standing still if you're still, but moving in a constant direction if you're moving. All right, so let's kind of model what's happening with this, at the endolymph inside your ear. All right, so we said, okay, let's say you're sitting still, okay, and you could do this, what holiday is coming up? Ah, yeah, St. Patrick's Day. Okay, so you could put a bunch of beer bottles on the table and impress your friends, right, and glasses, maybe you want some wine, right, champagne, so put a bunch of champagne glasses on the table, fill them up, on top of a tablecloth, okay, and you could demonstrate inertia by doing what? Pulling the tablecloth out from underneath all those glasses and nothing's going to spill, right? And so that's a property of inertia. So what happened to that endolymph when all of a sudden you started moving your head like this? So the paper is your head or the semicircular canals. The endolymph is the fluid inside those semicircular canals and you start moving. You move, but what about the endolymph? It stayed stationary, okay? So this is you as well as the cupula. Whenever you start to spin, the cupula starts to move with you, but what about the endolymph? It's staying stationary, so as the cupula is moving through the stationary endolymph, it pushes on the cupula and it bends those stereocilia in the opposite direction that you're moving in. Okay? All right, now what is another trick that you used to do when you were a little kid, or maybe last week? Okay? Oh yeah, question. Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that when we get through this. Let me put the whole concept together. All right, so now what would happen to you if you started spinning? Would you get really sick? You wouldn't ever do something like that, probably. No, okay. So when you start spinning, that stimulates your semicircular canals, right? And you spin and spin and spin and spin, and then all of a sudden stop all of a sudden, and you look at the room, what's happening to the room? Is the room stationary? No, it's still spinning. Now, why is it still spinning, even though you're stopped? Because that endolymph in your semicircular canals, as you spin, it catches up to your velocity. So the endolymph starts to spin with your head, right? And then you stop. What about the endolymph? It keeps going, and it pushes the cupula the other way, sending action potentials to your brain, saying, you know, you're really moving, and this is the essence of motion sickness, okay? And that is, the inner ear is telling your brain that you're moving, but what does your visual system say? You're stopped. So your brain gets really confused. It doesn't move if you're moving or stopped, and that gives you the sense of dysphoria or motion sickness or seasickness, okay? And so there's really no way to unswitch your inner ear, but there are different visual tricks people sometimes learn to help control motion sickness, like trying to look at something that's not moving, and you know, it gets better or worse depending on, people can outgrow it too, or it can get worse as you get older, all depends, we don't really know why that is. All right, so let's do a little experiment right here that models how the endolymph keeps moving even though you stop, okay, and pushes on the cupula the other way. All right, so what's this bottle again? Endolymph. So let's get it, I can't really do a spinning on a tabletop, but let's pretend we're like spinning, and then we're going to stop, and if we stop suddenly, what happens to the endolymph? It should keep moving because it has inertia. So we'll get it moving and then stop, but it takes a while for the endolymph to stop, and as it's moving, okay, it's moving past the cupula the other way, and it bends the cupula, causing action potentials to go to the brain to give you that sense of spinning even though you're stopped. All right, well, I don't know. Try reading the book. Maybe the book makes more sense than the experiment on the table, but maybe the experiment on the table makes more sense for you, okay? But what are some similarities? You have this gelatinous mass compared to the utricle and saccule. You have hair cells that bend one way or the other. Okay, just remember, these are what, microscopic hairs, not like what you have on your head. Okay, let's move on to the sense of hearing. I tell you what, one other question, what kind of stimulus is producing these action potentials that are going to go to the brain? Is it a chemical Is it light? Okay. What other kinds of, is it painful stimulus? It's what kind of stimulus is it? It's mechanical, right? It's the moving of those stereo cilia. Okay. Okay. So, let's just talk about hearing for a little bit. And I was hearing things. Okay. All right. So, sound waves are mechanical waves. And you know, we had an earthquake this morning, and I just happened to be watching the news, and they did a really nice model of the earthquake, you know, Pico Rivera. They had this nice model, and it showed waves traveling over the surface of the earth, and how as it moved away from the epicenter, the amplitude of the wave decreased, right? Like a graded potential. All right, so sound is like that wave from an earthquake. It's a mechanical, physical wave. It's a pressure wave. It's not like electromagnetic radiation that our eyes can perceive. It's a physical change in pressure moving through the air. All right, and waves can be characterized by two kinds of quantities. Right, it can be characterized by the frequency, and it can be quantified by the intensity. All right, so what does a wave look like? I'll just draw it on a board. So here is a marker, hopefully dark enough. No. Not even close. All right, so here's a wave. Here's another wave. Ah, really nice. All right, and so from one point in the wave to another point in that wave, that's what we call the wavelength. Okay, and it's going to vibrate above and below zero pressure. So this is zero right here. This distance is what we call the intensity or the amplitude of a wave. Right, so amplitude. And which wave to your ear would sound louder? This one here? Oh, this would be really nice if I had another color. All right, which one would sound louder? The black wave or the blue wave? Yeah, the blue wave. Okay, because it has a higher amplitude. It's going to send more action potentials to the brain at a higher frequency, right, a repetition rate. All right, so that's amplitude. All right, the frequency is how many waves you can put in a particular time. So, for instance, let's double the frequency. What would that look like? Where should I draw that? Oh, I wish I had another color. Maybe blue would be okay. All right, so here is, how am I doing? Ah, not bad. Okay, so here's a wave. It has the same amplitude as this black one right here, but now it's got what? It's got two wavelengths for that same period of time. So it's higher frequency. So frequency is how many waves are packaged into that same period of time. And that's how we talk about waves, amplitude and frequency. Intensity is loudness. The way that we measure frequency is in cycles per second. We call that hertz. That actually should be a capital H right there because it was actually coined after somebody's name, right? And the pitch of a tone that we hear is just a difference in frequency, right? So higher frequency means more waves per time. Lower frequency means that it's a longer wavelength in time. All right, so here is our ear. And we just got done talking about equilibrium. What part of this apparatus right here is important for static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium? Is just the vestibule and these semicircular canals, which are in the inner ear. Now, what about for hearing? What part of this apparatus right here do you need in order to hear something? You need the outer ear, the middle ear, as well as the inner ear for hearing. Right? So, structurally quite different. And in particular, the part of the inner ear for hearing is the cochlea. All right? So let's look inside the cochlea. The cochlea kind of looks like a snail, right? That's all rolled up. Now, what is this cochlea really? Why is it all rolled up? Think of a musical instrument. That cochlea is really a piano, okay? That's in your inner ear. But we'd all look pretty silly if we had these pianos sticking out of our ears. So how did evolution solve that problem? It kind of rolled up the keyboard, right? So it fits in a small space. So biology does that all the time, Right? It takes something big and folds it up so it can fit into a smaller spot. Who could think of maybe another example of how convolutions are a way to make something that's very big fit into a small space? The ruge of your stomach, for instance, or maybe the gyri and sulci on the surface of your brain. That's just a way of putting a big surface area, giving you a lot of thinking power, but putting it in a small package. Okay. All right, so here we have this piano, but for our discussion, let's unroll it. We don't need to have it all rolled up like that when we're trying to understand something about the cochlea. So look what we got right here. We've got the cochlea, and we've unrolled it. So it's a nice, long, linear piano. I can't remember if this is a picture in your book or not. Is this from your book? Okay. Guess what? You got to read that chapter. All right, so here we have, what part of the ear is this right here? Outer ear, tympanic membrane. Here is the middle ear, right? The malleocincus and stapes, and you got a nice change in surface area from the tympanic membrane to the oval window. So sound enters the cochlea through the what window? Oval window, and then it goes through the cochlea, right? And in particular, the scala vestibuli, which has perilymph in it, and eventually the sound, right, can maybe take a shortcut across the cochlear duct, which has endolymph in it, into, this would be the scala tympani, and the scala tympani releases the energy into the middle ear via the round window. All right, so there's another membrane right here that vibrates back and forth, and it's got to release that energy, because if the energy got trapped inside the cochlea, if it couldn't be released, guess what would happen to the cochlea? Well, it would break apart. It would rip apart. All right, so that energy has to be released through the round window. So remember, energy goes in through the oval window, around through the perilymph, or maybe takes a shortcut across the endolymph, and then is released by the round window back into the middle ear right here. All right, so this chamber right here that has endolymph in it, we call this the cochlear duct. And there are special sensory receptor cells in the cochlear duct. And what was the sensory receptor cell for static equilibrium? What kind of cell was that? Really sounds strange. A hair cell, right. I could make fun of you, but you're right. It's a hair cell in there. What about for kinetic equilibrium? What kind of receptor cell? It's a hair cell, right? All right, so guess what kind of receptor cells are in this organ right here that allows you to hear? They're going to be hair cells as well, right? Because these physical vibrations are going to vibrate stereo cilia in that organ of Corti, and I'll have to talk about the rest of the ear next time. All right, so remember we got a piano right here. What can you tell me about the sound from one end of the piano to the other end? Way on the left. What can you tell me about way on the left? Really low frequency. Way on the right is really high frequency. So depending on the position of the piano, you hear different tones. The same thing for the organ of Corti right here. This is the low frequency end, this is the high frequency end, and then in the middle, you've got middle frequencies. Yeah, so this is the part that's damaged. And typically that's what happens. You know, a lot of people have pretty good low frequency hearing, but if you can only hear low frequencies, so it's just, everything just sounds muffled. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I used to sit in the bass cabinet.
Yeah.
Stupid little girl. But now I have, my hearing is affected in such that, like, I have a hypersensitivity.
Well, what frequencies?
High frequencies.
Okay. Because you can still hear those.
So is that I can tolerate lower frequencies because I can't hear them as well. So I can hear the higher ones better.
Yeah. For instance, I'm colorblind. The colors that I can't really see are red and green, but I can see yellow better than anybody else. All right, so I told my parents when I was growing up I didn't want anything yellow in my room because it gave me headaches. Because I can't really see red or green, and yellow is just like a flashing neon light to me. Okay, now it doesn't bother me so much, but I think you're maybe describing that same kind of thing where a receptor system is amplified and the things that you're sensing normally are amplified way too much, but the things you're deficient in, maybe you can still hear because everything is amplified. Okay, so you're a little bit hypersensitive to low frequencies.
Well, but weird, yeah, but I can still hear really well. Like,
yeah.
But maybe that's because I'm hearing the higher frequencies of whatever.
I think your mind is automatically trying to balance a deficit in hearing. And it's going to get to a point where your mind can't balance the spectrum of frequencies out, and then you would need, you know, a hearing device, and then the hearing device has to be matched up to your particular spectrum of hearing. And that's kind of sometimes difficult to do. Some people with hearing aids, when they go into an elevator, and if the hearing aid isn't adjusted properly to attenuate a certain sound frequency, then it becomes obnoxious when that frequency is there.
So next shelf, don't let my kids go to rave?
I don't know. You just stand far away. Or you know what's really good? You can still hear a pretty good spectrum. Put cotton in yours.
Yeah, right? Earplugs. Everywhere I go.
Well, earplugs deadens everything too much. But cotton has always worked for me pretty well. Maybe 3 or 4. I'm not sure. You know, I have to think about that. Ask me next time. Okay. So, we have autonomic nervous system. That's 9. And senses, endocrinology, maybe muscle. Yeah.